Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Yvonne Rydin, and I'm very glad to welcome you to the London School of Economics on behalf of the Centre for Environmental Policy and Governance. We've got a very exciting lecture ahead of us, so with no further ado, I'm going to hand over to Asif Suef, who will now introduce both herself and the speaker. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, friends, good evening. My name is Ahdaf Suef, and I'm here as a member of the board of LIFT, the London International Festival of Theatre, to welcome you to this year's offering in the LIFT lecture series, Imagining a Cultural Commons. We're extremely lucky to have tonight a very distinguished, interesting, and controversial speaker. The president of the Foundation on Economic Trends, Washington, D.C., the author, economist, environmentalist, and futures thinker, Jeremy Rifkin, who also, since we're at LSE, I should say that he teaches at Wharton. Jeremy Rifkin's output has been huge. I invite you to Google him, as I innocently did, and found 53,200 entries. And for my part, I hope his influence on what happens to our world turns out to be equally enormous. For our purposes tonight, though, I would like to concentrate on his three most recent books. In The Age of Access, Jeremy Rifkin writes about the commodification of culture that is happening through the agency of the big media corporations. He challenges arts organizations, of which LIFT is one, to re-examine their relations with the business world and with public policy, and to renew their role in fostering a cultural commons. In The Hydrogen Economy, he explores the possibilities of moving beyond an oil-based economy to one based on hydrogen. If this is ever to be possible, it will, of course, entail an ability to negotiate between cultures at both local and international levels. In his most recent book, The European Dream, he examines Europe's dream of itself, the character that it dreams of for itself, as that character unfolds and crystallizes through the development of the European community. He contends, bless you, that if you consider what makes a people great and what constitutes a better way of life, then Europe is beginning to surpass America. Jeremy Rifkin is American, by the way. It's probably safe to say that one central insight informing all these writings is that as the world becomes more and more globally connected, no nation, no people, no person can exist as an island unto himself, herself, themselves. For those of you familiar with LIFT, the convergence of ideas will be obvious. LIFT has been engaged for 20 years in creating a cultural commons by bringing cutting-edge theater from every part of the world to London and by staging performances in some 30 London venues, ranging from the traditional to the extraordinary. LIFT has created a space for cultural exchange and has opened up the possibilities of dialogue and debate at both global and local levels. By engaging with corporations through its Business Arts Forum, LIFT has sought to redefine and develop the relationship between the arts and big business. A couple of years ago, LIFT started its massive inquiry into the nature and function of theater. And by setting up its lecture series, of which this is one, LIFT has sought to bring us up to date with developments in technology and the shifting relationships between the economic sphere and those areas of life that have traditionally been held in common. And one of the most important of these areas is culture. Previous speakers in this series have reminded us of the role that culture and its free exchange play in social adaptation and survival. And if we think of culture broadly as the way in which a society does things, organizes personal relationships, for example, we can see the huge inroads that technology controlled by corporations is making into it. And we can also see the role that art has always performed in engaging with the culture, questioning it, endorsing it, subverting it, maybe. What happens when the entire cultural space, including the space for art, is colonized by commerce? Not what happens to art or to artists, but what happens to human society? LIFT has asked Jeremy Rifkin to speak to elucidate for us what the role of art, and specifically the theater, might be in the macroeconomic context he describes. The issue of oil, for example, affects every one of us at different levels. Its impact on our daily lives, its impact on the global environment, and on the politics of the world we live in. An understatement, I guess. I understand that Jeremy will speak for about 70 minutes, after which your responses will be welcomed. Professor Yvonne Rydin, Professor of Environmental Planning and Director of the LSE's Center for Environmental Policy and Governance, will moderate the post-lecture discussion. Finally, but crucially, Lyft would like to thank everyone who has made this event possible. Thank you, Morgan Stanley, for sponsoring this event. Thank you also to our supporters, the Greater London Authority, the London Hydrogen Partnership, and the Arts Council, and our co-host, the London School of Economics. We thank all of you for being with us tonight, and above all, of course, we thank Jeremy Rifkin for being here to speak to us.
You need the front row. Okay, good evening, everybody. And thank you for signing. I appreciate it this evening. Okay. The great economic revolutions in history, the really great ones, they occur when two things happen. First, a basic change in the way we organize the energy of the planet. Secondly, a basic change in the way we communicate with each other to organize the new energy regimes. The convergence, the coming together of new energy regimes and new communication regimes as the command and control mechanisms to organize it, those are the turning points in history. They're few and far between. They change the human equation fundamentally. Example, Iraq is in the news the last few years. Let's go back to ancient Sumeria for a few minutes. The Sumerians engage in a very radical experiment. They discovered the way to capture the sun's energy in cereal plants. Then they stored the grain. And that surplus was the prime energy mover for 10,000 years of human history, the agricultural revolution. But when the Sumerians went to agriculture, it was complicated. They had to have knowledge of hydraulics and irrigation, the changing constellations in the heavens, because they had to know when to sow and reap. They had to store and distribute the grain. It required a new communication vehicle between human beings, cuneiform. The coming together of writing and agriculture was one of the great transition points in human history. The early modern era, Gutenberg reinvents the print press. Chinese already had it, but his had movable type. This communication revolution had absolutely no economic mission for three centuries. It had a social mission, the Protestant Reformation, mass producing Bibles in vernacular. And of course, Luther and Calvin said, each person stands alone with their God. Learn to read the Bible and you do not need the priesthood of the Vatican as an intermediary. Great social upheaval. But the economic mission of that print press didn't become really clear until James Watt patented the steam engine at the dawn of the American Revolution. We went to coal. We dug up the burial grounds of the Jurassic Age, moved it with steam power. We greatly increased the pace, the speed, the flow, the connectivity, and the density of human exchange. We had to have a new command and control mechanism to organize all of this. Print. In hindsight, try to imagine organizing the first industrial revolution with codecs. Couldn't have done it. The telegraph and telephone preceded the internal combustion engine oil by just a few years and became the communication vehicle for the second industrial revolution. The reason I mention this, we had a great communication revolution in the 1990s. The personal computer, with digital technology, we could create seamless relationships between communication mediums. We connected a billion people, the central nervous system of a billion people connected. Think about this. 300 years ago, the average European, or the average person in the world, would come into contact with less than 300 or 400 people in their whole lifetime. Now you can connect the central nervous system to a billion people at the speed of light. No matter, obviously, stress has become a major issue because the central nervous system was not designed for this kind of stimulation and fright, flight, flow, which is another issue for another time. And actually, most of the information a peasant would have had 500 years ago would have been on the stained glass windows of the local cathedral. Now, one Sunday edition of The Observer more information than you get in a lifetime 300 years ago. But here's the point of this communication revolution. We connected the central nervous system to the human beings. We increased productivity. We use it as a social tool. But we didn't understand its real historical mission. You know, I teach at the Wharton School in the United States. It's always a pleasure being at the London School of Economics. I teach there. I've been there a long time in the Executive and Advanced Management Program. We bring in business leaders from all over the world. And during the 90s, they tell me about their dot-com companies, and I would think, my God, this is delusional. Many of these companies, what do they actually do? Of course, most of them actually came and went. The reason is we didn't understand the mission here. What's going to become clear in the next 2 or 3 years is that this decentralized global communication systems that we developed in the 1990s is the new command and control mechanism for a new energy regime. The new energy regime is distributive generation of hydrogen, basic element in the universe, stuff of the stars, ubiquitous, and when you employ it, the only byproducts are pure water and heat. A fuel cell is analogous to a personal computer. The fuel cell, powered by hydrogen, you and I become our own producers of our energy. The analogy, with a computer, you and I generate our own information. Well, at a critical point, we were all generating information and we wanted to share it. We connected on the internet. Try to imagine hundreds of millions of fuel cells. Every automobile, every bus, every truck, every home, every office, every human body with portables, fuel cells everywhere. Each person producing their own energy. But then we want to share it to create critical mass. We're going to take the same software, the same hardware, the same architecture that we developed in Silicon Valley in the 1980s, and we're going to reconfigure every power grid in the UK and across Europe and around the world in the next 25 to 30 years so that when you and I generate power with our individual fuel cell, we can sell the excess back to the grid peer-to-peer in real time. Distributive generation of energy, decentralized communication organizing. Third Industrial Revolution. It will be as powerful in its impact as the coming together of the print press with steam, coal, rail, and print. First Industrial Revolution, multiplier effect the entire 19th century. It will be as powerful in its impact as the coming together of the telegraph, telephone, electricity with the internal combustion engine and oil, roads and automobiles, Second Industrial Revolution, multiplier effect the entire 20th century. Coming together of decentralized communication and distributed generation of hydrogen, multiplier effect, 21st century. And it will change everything, as did these prior revolutions. Remember, when we went from solar flow to solar stock, and from burning wood and from animal and human power to stored sun in the form of fossil fuels, it changed the human equation. We went from city-states and guilds to national markets in a market exchange economy. We went from feudalism to capitalism. We went from monarchy to democracy. And we changed the consciousness of culture at the same time. I'm not going to argue the point of which came first, the change in the energy regime or the change in the ideas and the values, the culture, but we know they came about the same time. Let me make a suggestion before we go any further. You can take it or leave it. What's your name? Giacomo. Now, you know, when you're out with a friend, do you take notes? You don't take notes, no. And I'll bet you can relay every single part of that conversation, if it's sufficiently interesting, and all the nuances to someone else the next day, right? Notes, are you here for a class? How many are here because a professor sent you? All right. Let me tell you, this is going to be a born-again experience. Trust me, you'll all remember everything that was discussed tonight. I guarantee it. And if you didn't remember, it wasn't worth it. So this is going to be a born-again experience. Give me your pens. They're having withdrawal symptoms as we speak. Look at this. Okay, you've been very nice. This will be a new experience. Trust me, this is going to change your life. Okay? All right. New energy regimes go together with new ways for people to rethink their cultures. They go together. It's impossible to have a new energy regime unless we have a new consciousness, a new way of thinking about the human spirit, what our relationship is to our fellow human beings, our fellow creatures, and the earth we live in. So tonight I'm going to talk about the new energy regime, only as context, so that we can talk about what is the new cultural vision that's emerging here in Europe, especially the European dream, that's beginning to provide the environment for a new energy era, the spirit for a new regime in history, because you can't have one without the other. Let me back up for a moment. There are three crises facing the world today. They're all involved with oil. And our ability to resolve these crises will determine whether your children have a legacy well into the mid part of this century. Global warming, third world debt, and the increasing geopolitical struggle in the Middle East. Remember, the whole world runs by oil. We grow our foods and petrochemical fertilizers and pesticides. Our clothes are primarily made out of petrochemical synthetics. Our plastics, our building material, our pharmaceutical products by and large are petrochemical, our power, our heat, our transport, our light. Anthropologically, this is the oil era. But now three crises. First, global warming. Global warming is the entropy bill for 200 years of using fossil fuels. Some of you older people may have suffered through a book I wrote about a quarter of a century ago called Entropy, the Laws of Thermodynamics Applied to Economics. You cannot escape the laws of thermodynamics. The question is, not breaking even, but when do you lose? Who pays the bill? We've been burning all that stored energy. Now the CO2 blanket up in the atmosphere is getting thicker, and we're not getting enough heat off the planet. It's as simple and profound as that. So for 10 years, scientists huddled together on the auspices of the United Nations from every academy of science in the world, and they came up with a report, the best we can do, given the modeling we have now. It's still primitive. But the report says, the UN report, we may see anywhere from a 2.5 degree Fahrenheit rise in temperature to 10 degrees plus. If it's 2.5 or 3, we're in trouble, but we can adjust, maybe. If it's anywhere near 6, 7, 8, or 9, I have no prescription to offer you. It's 9 degrees Fahrenheit that separated us from the last ice age. And 15,000 years ago, the northern hemisphere was under thousands of feet of ice. Qualitative shift in the chemistry of the planet. The scientific report of the UN said, watch for the anecdotal signs. You'll start to see the great snow masses on our mountain ranges disappear from Kilimanjaro to the Himalayas. It's happening. They said, we began to see much more violent weather patterns, tornadoes, typhoons, hurricanes in the Caribbean. It's happening. We'd see more seawater rise and coastal damage and loss of land on the coast. It's happening. They said that we would see more insects, viruses, and crossing species boundaries and crossing geographic confines and becoming health threats in new environments. We're seeing it. America's plagued by West Nile virus right now. We pick up dead crows in our front yard. They're not there anymore. 2 years ago, they all disappeared. And of course, humans get infected as well. And now we have the Asian tiger mosquito. We can't go out in our backyards. And finally, here's the litmus test. They said, watch the Arctic, because it's going to be ice-free by 2030 to 2050. Sure enough, we're seeing those ice flows and they're breaking off at an accelerating rate. And then you read in the paper this week that it appears in the last 2 years there's been an acceleration in the flow of CO2. We don't know if it's simply a momentary change in the acceleration or a dramatic change. One last thing about this. We always assume that the temperature rises steadily over a century. Still, not much time to adjust. But a National Academy of Science report in the U.S. 2 years ago said, no, no, no. When you look at the geological record, that's not the way it happens. They looked back at the geological record, our scientists, and they found that in the Younger Dryas level in the geology, in a 10-year span, one-third of all the temperature change we've experienced in 15,000 years hit in 10 years. There was a tipping point in the chemistry of the planet. I hope that's not what's happening with this temperature rise they're reporting on this week. If we were to measure human accomplishments in terms of sheer impact, we'd have to say regretfully that global warming may turn out to be the greatest single accomplishment of the human race, albeit a negative one. We've actually affected the chemistry of a planet at human hands in less than a century. That's pure power, awesome in its potential impact. Global warming, the oil connection. Secondly, third world debt. Transparent, but we don't talk about it. If we think we're in trouble today at $53 a barrel on the world market for oil this afternoon, what do you think is going on in the third world? The economists at Wharton and LSE and other schools said to the developing countries in the 50s and 60s, modernize with oil so you can be a player in the capitalist market. Oil was a commodity then, selling at $3 a barrel. No one anticipated OPEC. Within 12 weeks of OPEC imposing that oil embargo in the 70s, oil shot from $3 to $12 a barrel. The price has never gone down. And now we're at a new plateau. And the prevailing wisdom is it may go down, but we're not going under 40 again. What happens when it reaches 60 or 70? Look how precarious it is. Is it Nigeria today? They blew up one pipeline. Prices went up. There's not that many nexus points, and all it takes is a little bit of terrorism to get the job done. But how is it related to third world debt? Well, since the OPEC oil embargo, third world countries have been desperately borrowing money from the World Bank to try to pay for oil they can't afford. So today, 83 cents out of every dollar borrowed in the third world is used to pay back the debt. They're not even getting the oil. 89 countries are worse off in real terms today than they were 10 years ago. That's not a good sign. Never before in history have we seen this kind of divide in the human race between the possessed and the dispossessed, and now the connected and the unconnected. Go back to Paleolithic history, no big divides. We hadn't developed containers. We had no way to store surplus. But if you go back even to Neolithic era, in ancient antiquity, medieval Europe, early modern era, we've never seen this kind of divide between the haves and have-nots as we have today. The 356 wealthiest families in the world today, we can put them in this room. Their combined assets now equal the annual income of 40% of the human race. The three richest families, the Waltons, Walmart, Bill Gates family, and Warren Buffett, their combined assets now equal the annual income of the 940 million poorest people living on Earth. Global warming, the oil connection. Third world debt, the oil connection, and the Middle East. To cut to the chase, does anyone really think that United States troops and British troops would be in Iraq if it wasn't the second largest oil reserves in the world? But it's a dangerous geopolitical game. It reminds me of Vietnam when I was the age of some of you young people here. We're in and we can't get out. There's no win here. It's only the question of when we say the troops leave. But when you began to understand the geopolitics of this, this was a bold move to stabilize the oil production of the world in case the Saudi family fell. Very dangerous. Global warming, the oil connection, increasing divide between the haves and have-nots and third world debt, the oil connection, the increasing geopolitical struggle in the Middle East. Everyone wants that oil, my friends. China, India, Europe, Japan, America. This would be enough to contend with, but we have a second problem. The conventional wisdom, OECD, the International Energy Administration, the U.S. Department of Energy, U.S. Geological Survey, here's the orthodox thinking. At a standard 2% growth rate in the increase of oil, middle scenario, we peak with oil production around 2037. Peak is when half the oil is used up. But that's the end of the era, interestingly, because that's the top of the Hubert bell curve. Once you hit the top of the bell curve, prices shoot way through the roof. It's over. In the last 4 years, about a dozen of the best geologists in the world, world class, have been going back and re-looking at the numbers with new computer models. They're saying these numbers may have been inflated, to be charitable. And when they've run the numbers, their results tell them that we may peak as early as 2010, no later than 2020. I don't know who's right. If you read chapter 2 of the book, The Hydrogen Economy, it's a pretty tedious chapter, but I went back and forth and back and forth. Are the pessimists right? Are the optimists right? Then it hit me. It doesn't make a damn bit of difference. It took me 5 months to figure that out. What's the difference if it peaks in 2010 to 2020 or 2030 to 2040? From a geohistorical point of view, it's completely irrelevant. And even from the point of view of economic planning, it's completely irrelevant. What they all agree to, when we do peak, two-thirds of all the remaining oil left on this planet, it's in the Persian Gulf. Now we understand why U.S. troops are billeted in Iraq. The energy companies are aware of this reality. They're beginning to diversify their portfolio. They're moving to natural gas. Natural gas burns less CO2 than oil. The problem is the same studies show that natural gas shadows oil on the bell curve. You get a few more years, not very much. It's not a long-term solution. There are plenty of other fossil fuels. We're not running out of fossil fuels. There's tar sand in Canada, Suncrude and Syncor. They're right now competitive on world markets at $12 a barrel, and they're the largest supplier of energy to the United States. There's heavy oil in Venezuela. There's plenty of coal in America and around the world. The problem, they're all dirty. They emit more CO2, and we didn't factor them into the UN studies. We'll have to go back and run the numbers. But can we afford to make that shift into fossil fuels after we see the telltale signs of global warming all around us? I believe that we're in the last half century of a great energy era that began with the coal fields of Newcastle and now winding down in the oil fields of the Persian Gulf, fossil fuels. And there is a new energy regime on the horizon. It's clear, but it's difficult to see how we get there. Hydrogen, I believe, is the next energy era. It was inevitable. We call this decarbonization. Here's the good news. If you look at the history of energy, we've been getting cleaner, not dirtier. Wood burns very poorly with CO2. Believe it or not, coal is cleaner than wood. Oil is cleaner than coal. Natural gas is cleaner than oil. But once you hit hydrogen, you're off the carbon cycle altogether. How to make the divide and get over the bridge to the next era? Let me say there are many civilizations in history that have come and gone for many different reasons. Some because they reached an entropy watershed for their energy regime and couldn't or wouldn't make the transition into a new era. Next time you visit Rome, think of this. Their whole energy regime was agriculture. They fed their 1.5 million slaves. A lot of their aristocracy was on free welfare with grain. They billeted their troops around the world, and they denuded that soil base year after year after year. And then runoff when they denuded the forest. Year after year, the soil lost. Well before the hordes were at the gates of Rome, it was over. The energy regime was gone. And when next time you visit Rome, think of this when you're next to the Pantheon. There were 1.5 million people in an incredible civilization there in the 4th century. In the 8th century, there were 70,000 people living in rubble. And it took 1,000 years for the next city of 1 million, London, to be put back on the world stage. Hydrogen's ubiquitous, it's clean. Now the problem, it's not free floating. We need to know that hydrogen is not a primary energy source, it's a secondary carrier. You have to get hydrogen from something else, and that's where the problems come in. We can extract hydrogen from coal, oil, and gas. And most of the hydrogen comes from natural gas. We steam out the hydrogen, but natural gas is in short supply. We could go to coal, and the coal industry sees this whole hydrogen idea as a new lease on life, and they say, trust us, build the coal power plants, we'll extract the hydrogen from the coal, and then give us enough time and research money, and we'll figure out how to sequester the CO2 underground. Is this starting to sound deja vu? You older folks? This is the exact arguments we had in the nuclear industry in the 50s. It's now 50 years later, and we still don't know how to transport it safely, and we don't know how to bury it. Yucca Flats, we spent all that money in the deserts of America, and it's leaking, and they haven't even put the first nuclear material in there yet. How are they going to keep it steadfast for 10,000 years? Try to imagine sequestering CO2 in that volume, underground, even if there were enough medium, and it never escapes for all of eternity. That is what I call really wishful thinking. And if it does escape, imagine the catastrophe when you have leakage of CO2 in massive volume, free-floating up into the atmosphere. The short, happy life of planet Earth. We could use nuclear power to the task with electrolysis. The problem is with nuclear power is Thatcher and Reagan killed nuclear power with deregulation because that power source was totally subsidized by government. I work with some of the largest power and energy companies in the world. Let me tell you, the power companies I work with, including those who own nuclear power plants, have absolutely no intention of building a new nuclear power plant unless you and I are willing to subsidize it again with our tax dollars. Too expensive. When the stock market bubble burst in the year 2000, the big hits were telecom and utilities. They lost a third of their equity. There's no liquidity. The power plants I work with, the companies are desperate to even build little gas-fired power plants, not big nuclear power. Secondly, we don't know how to get rid of the waste. That's a deal killer for me. We shouldn't be burdening future generations for 10,000 years with radioactive waste because of our short-term profligate standards of energy use. Third, and this is a crucial test, on 9/11, I was in Zurich, and I was on a conference call with an American power company I work with. 20 minutes into the call, they said, two planes have hit the World Trade Center. We have to lock down our nuclear power plants because they're the ones that were in harm's way. Like you, I had no idea. But I called my wife, said, get in the basement. We're in Washington. My staff never made it past the Pentagon on the subway that morning. But it dawned on me a while after, this first attack is symbolic, the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. The next time it's really serious, go after the power structure. That's what real terrorism is about. These power plants are totally unprotected. It's not the towers. The towers have been measured against 727s, but not 747s. We're really worried about the spent nuclear rods. They're just out in the open all over the world. Any terrorist, and I can say it now because they all know it, any terrorist can pull up in a car on the side road, there's no security, take out a handheld missile, there are thousands of them, lob it over the yard, hit the nuclear rods, that's it. It's insane. You have to decommission nuclear power even quicker now, post 9/11. There is another way to use hydrogen, and that is we can harness renewable energy, solar, wind, geothermal, hydro, the winds, tides, biomass. That is, use renewable energy, generate electricity. Electricity flows. You can't really store it except in small batteries. You've got to let it flow. But if you have surplus electricity you don't need because it's not peak load, what do? Electrolyze water. Remember high school chemistry? The anode, the cathode, you're not sure, you weren't there. You were in art class, weren't you? Yeah, the anode and the cathode, you put it in the water and you separate out the hydrogen. How many of you did that in school? Okay. We just found out where the humanities students are, where the science students are. All right. We can also use biomass, and that is to take energy crops or agricultural waste, and if we find a way to do it in a non-polluting fashion, extract the hydrogen out directly. The problem here is you're generating electricity twice. There's a big thermodynamic bill. Please don't ask me afterwards, isn't it true that using renewables with hydrogen, you have a net energy loss? You always have a net energy loss with every single energy transaction on the planet. It's called the first and second laws of thermodynamics. When a predator eats a victim, for example, only 10 to 20% of the energy of the victim goes into the predator. The rest is energy loss. Oil, gas, everything with burning wood, it's all energy loss. The question is how much? You're generating electricity twice. First, to get the electricity, then electrolyze the water to grab the hydrogen for the fuel cell. But, and here's the point, many environmentalists here in the UK and in Europe, including some of the big environmental groups in this country, do not understand why hydrogen is absolutely inseparable from renewable energy. You can't have one without the other. So some say, why don't we just concentrate on renewable energy? Isn't hydrogen take us into another route? Renewable energy is intermittent. The sun isn't always shining. The wind isn't always blowing. The water isn't always flowing over the dam when there's drought. You have to have a way to store intermittent energy. Hydrogen is the way to do it. In good times, when the sun's shining, the wind's blowing, the water's flowing, grab the hydrogen out of the water so that when there is bad times, you have backup for your power. You have to have it at all times for power for transport. You have hydrogen buses running now. You can't run a hydrogen bus on a windmill or solar reflectors. So when we began benchmarking into renewables, let's say 10% of British electricity, 12%, 15%, at a critical point, you better have backup. Brazil learned this lesson the hard way in 2001. I was down with Petrobras a year ago. See, 92% of the electricity in Brazil is hydroelectric. It's water coming over the dam, and they make electricity. 92%. They're the only really renewable energy power in the world, the big countries. They had drought. The water stopped flowing in 2001. Electricity went off all over the country. You have to have a way to store renewables. Two bell curves. The cost of oil is going to keep going up. We've been subsidizing oil, gas, and coal for a long time. The direct costs are up. They're at $53 a barrel. There are going to be ebbs and flows, but it's going up. It'll go down a little bit, but not at the low level it was before. It'll keep going up, down a little, then up higher. The indirect costs are shooting through the roof. Global warming is the big indirect cost. The reinsurance companies I work with don't even know how to model the loss, because when you look at all the loss, to just take a look at four hurricanes in Florida and the loss that accounted for, and one little communities, set of communities in Florida, magnify that to everywhere in the world with traumatic weather change. We're talking trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars. Then there's the indirect cost of military. The U.S. spends more money militarily securing the oil in the Middle East than the net value of the oil that we get. That was before the war. That was $200 billion ago. So while the cost for oil is going up on the bell curve, the cost for renewable energies, especially wind, but also solar and others, is going down. And the cost of fuel cells is going down as we develop the technology. Moore's law has begun to set in on wind, and it's about to set in on fuel cells. We saw this in software and biotech. You get to a critical point where there's so much technology moving, so much talent at the task, that you begin seeing a doubling of your knowledge and a halving of your costs every 18 months. We saw it with software. We saw it in biotech. We're seeing it in renewables. Secondly, because you generate the power at the end of the line, you can co-generate the heat back. You don't waste as much. Third, the fuel cell's 2.5 times more efficient than the internal combustion engine. That's extraordinary. And fourth, economies of scale. Sure, the first car cost $1 million. But after the 100,000th car comes off the line, you're down into a range that you can afford. Always prototypes are more. So two bell curves, oil and gas going up, the cost of renewable energy and fuel cells going down. As they begin to meet each other, we have the opportunity for a great change in history. But that doesn't mean it's an inevitability. To have a change of this magnitude, where we're changing the communication and energy regime of the world and reconfiguring the infrastructure of the entire planet, requires a complete, full mobilization of every aspect of life, the commercial arena, government, and civil society, all three pillars, at an enormous scale to make this transition. Leave it to the market alone, this will not happen in time or ever. Stationary fuel cells. Many companies I work with don't trust the power grid because there's so much lack of liquidity that there's more power blackouts coming. We saw the power blackout in North America. You had one in London. You think those are the last power blackouts? We have an old creaky power grid. We don't have enough power capacity to meet increasing demand, and our power companies don't have the liquidity. So companies I work with, are beginning to say, let's have backup generation, Stirling or fuel cells. And we'll go off the grid, we'll have our own, we'll sell our energy back. We'll only go on the grid when it's cheap. But when the power's about to go out, forget it. You remember the silhouette of the Manhattan skyline on the Time and Newsweek and the magazines when it all went dark last year? Remember there was one building that seemed strangely lit up in the middle? It was on Times Square. New skyscraper, backup fuel cell. One building. And of course, as the power goes out, the next time you're inconvenienced for a week like we were, and all your food goes bad, then the next week and the next week and you can't get to work, you may say, forget the plasma TV, I'm going to get the fuel cell. Or in case of London, so it's so expensive, forget the next dinner out, which is usually about $1,000. I don't know how you people live here. Very tough. Let's get the fuel cell back up. Portables. You're going to see portables in 36 months, Korean and Japanese. There's others coming from Europe and America. You'll be able to take a little hydrogen cartridge and power up your cell phone for 20 to 40 days. In your laptop. Everyone likes that. Autos. The auto companies have spent $2 billion plus on a hydrogen car. Most of my colleagues in the environmental community, and I come out of that community, I'm still engaged in the center of that community, my colleagues said, this is a trick. Oh, those auto companies, they're so tricky, they're little devils. They're tricking us because they're talking about this great hydrogen future way off in the utopian beyond. Why? Because the car companies are trying to take people's attention off the real issue, signing the Kyoto Accords in America, better fuel efficiency for cars, higher taxes for gasoline. So they're trying to divert us with a fantasy. $2 billion's not serious, but it's also not a trick. But I'll tell you what changed the whole thing. What's changed the whole thing, the reason we're here talking about hydrogen tonight, state of California. You can thank the state of California for this whole movement. 2 years ago, there was a rebellion in the assembly, and the state legislature passed a bill signed by Governor Gray Davis. If you want to sell a car in the state of California in 2009, you need near zero emissions. That's hydrogen. So what happened? GM sues the other car companies sue California. Very enlightened. And President Bush, if I remember, joined the suit. Disgraceful. But they've all dropped the suit now because they realize you can't lose California. It's the fourth largest economy in the world, and it's the biggest automobile market on Earth. So now the car companies are racing for hydrogen. If you talk to Mr. Wagner, GM, Bill Ford at the Ford Motor Company, Honda, Toyota, BMW, everyone wants to be first in the market, but no one wants to test the market. Classic. How many have seen the GM Highwire car? Anybody? It's amazing, isn't it? Who would have thought a stodgy old company like GM would be the first ones to reconceptualize the car? This looks like a Spider-Man car, beautiful, sleek, well-designed. Why the Italians did the design, they're the only ones that know how to do it. So they designed the car. They also did the software with the Swedes. And who did the engineering? The Germans, Castel Mainz. It's an Opel. It's a beautiful car, glass, more legroom than the internal combustion car. It burns hydrogen. The only exhaust is pure water and heat. You can drink the water. Astronauts have been drinking the water from their fuel cell power plants for 30 years. And this car is not a car. It's conceptualized to be a power plant on wheels. It's modular. You buy four wheels and a chassis, you lease it, thin little chassis, you take it home. Then you can snap on whatever car you want. You can snap on a convertible, station wagon, SUV. It has a day job and a night job. It transports you, and it's a power plant when you're not using it. There's no steering wheel in this car, my friends. There's no brakes, there's no pedal, there's no engine, there's no noise. It's all run by a joystick. It's a dot-com car for the dot-com generation. Now, my wife, who says to me, at your age, you cannot have a stick shift the next time. We've got to get you back to the automatic. I could not drive this car, but I'm sure many of you here could, and I'm sure every 12-year-old in London with about 10 minutes of trial and error could move this car down the block. But what's interesting here is this. It's a power plant. So you only use your car a small percentage of time a day. Most of the day it's idle. It's parked. Plug it back into the grid. It's a power plant. So if the cost of electricity is higher than the cost of the hydrogen fuel, you sell it back to the grid at a parking lot or an industrial park or in your home. If the whole fleet is hydrogen, bless you, and only 25% of the cars are plugged in at any given time to the grid, you replace every power plant in the world. It's like grid technology. We have software now that's allowing us to connect all the little digital computers, and so you have much more power than when you buy a few supercomputers. Same principle here. But in order to do this, what do we have to do? We have to reconfigure the communication grid. We have to go back to Silicon Valley, as I said earlier, and we take the same software, the same architecture that we developed so you could connect on the web, same architecture, and we reconfigure every power grid in the world so it's smart, decentralized, distributed, and when the price is right, you sell energy back to the grid, peer-to-peer, and you tell where it's going to go. Third Industrial Revolution. The biggest beneficiaries here will be the third world. The reason people are powerless is literal. They don't have power. It's literal. Throw out all the PhD theses. It's literal. They don't have power. As we are here tonight, two-thirds of the human race tonight have never made a single telephone call. They never picked up the phone, two-thirds of the human race. A third of the human race has no electricity, and another third has only minimum electricity. If you're looking for firewood and dung for 4 hours a day simply to heat rice for your kids, you're not a player. The connected, the unconnected, not just the possessed and the dispossessed. They did a study, the UN, in South Africa. For every 100 families that they brought electricity to, 20 new businesses. Why do I say this? As long as the third world is mired in oil, they're going to go down, down, down into the cellar. This is really getting desperate now. It's almost too late. It's desperate. Instead of going into desperate debt, you know, many of our protesters who take to the streets at these global forums, young people, and I think they've been great, the peaceful ones, because they've reminded us how unfair and inequitable and elitist this new globalization's been. But they say no global. That's not enough answer. We are globalizing. Whether we like it or not, we're becoming more densely connected to each other. The question is, how do we re-globalize from the bottom up? Because globalization from the top down failed. Why did it fail, by the way? Too narrow. Only 20% of the human race was connected. 80% of the human race wasn't involved. Globalization requires trust because you're eliminating all the boundaries and the barriers. The corporations forgot the lesson. You have to have trust because once you eliminate boundaries, everybody's in everybody's face. Does anyone think that trust is building on the planet between people? Globalization's failed. But now we have an opportunity for stage two, re-globalization from the bottom up. We had a saying in 1968, power to the people. Too bad, we overused it. We need to rebrand it, because actually, this has the potential to be power to the people, but let's not be naive. Major companies, energy, power companies, utility companies, and others will want to control it. But it's going to be like the web. There's going to be a struggle here. Remember the web? We all said information's going to run free. We're just going to share it with each other on the internet, remember? Well, then Microsoft came along and said, we're on the same page. We like this, but we'd like you to use the window. And then we said, hey, we're going to share music. We're going to share films. And then Disney and Time Warner said, we like that, but we'd like you to pay for the copyright. And we're going to put in tough encryption technology. Who won? From top or on the bottom? Well, you know, Bill Gates' his biggest nightmare when he goes to bed at night? It's another company. What's it called? Linux, open source, free code. A young radical activist with hair down to here in Scandinavia said, hey, why don't we just share the code with each other? It's now the code for all of business across Europe, IBM, America. Bill Gates will lose this. You can't win against free. And of course, the big companies want to protect copyright. The problem is, how many of you have kids under the age of 12? All the tired ones nodding out here. Now, this is a little dangerous, but walk into your kid's room, knock first, and then find out what your kid's doing on the computer. They're all downloading. We call it cheating. They call it sharing. Now, if you were going to bet on the question of will the big companies protect copyright, or then you have millions and millions of little Lilliputians all over the world who have nothing to do after school but to find a way to tweak the software to get it for free, who do you think is going to win? I mean, I'm serious. Do you really think these companies are going to protect this? No way. Same here with fuel cells, potentially distributed power, but we've got to make sure that end producers organize, producer cooperatives, municipal governments, industrial parks, trade unions, common interest development communities, housing districts. You organize, you have captive audiences, let them work a relationship with the power companies, they put in the fuel cells free, and then we sell them back the energy. Then there's win-win. The big energy companies, and they're here tonight, thank God for Dutch Shell and BP on one side here, and I know they're here tonight, because they're 10 years ahead of the rest of us. Their scenario units were absolutely brilliant. They left Mobil, Exxon, and the others in the dust. And they predict that by mid-century, we'll see maybe a third of our energy renewable with hydrogen storage. They're buying up renewable energy technologies. They have huge hydrogen divisions. And they have helped bring and usher this technology in. On the other hand, I got my eye on you here at Dutch Shell and BP, because you're ahead of the game. But the question is, can we learn to create a relationship so this is all going to be shared? There's room for win-win. There's room for the power companies and energy companies. Energy companies have deep pockets to help develop this technology. The power companies can help us run these decentralized grids. Companies like GE can produce the fuel cells, but we got to make damn sure the end producers can control the energy so that we work in partnership with all the other players. Then we all win. It's what we call deep reglobalization. So in the third world, get the solar cells on the rooftops, in the urban areas, in the villages. Get the hydrogen fuel cells there. Build the infrastructure, generate electricity so that poor people around the world can have a shot with electricity to be part of the globalizing process. Produce local with electricity, sell global. Is there any young person in this room that wouldn't say that's a good future? All right. So, I've been serving as an informal advisor, meaning not paid, labor of love to Romano Prodi, who was president of the European Commission. He asked me a few years ago, would I put in my 2 cents whenever I wanted to. I provided him with a strategic memorandum 2 years ago on how the European Union could become the first superpower to make a step-by-step transition out of fossil fuel dependency in the Middle East to renewable energy, hydrogen storage. We met, he gave the green light. A year later, the major companies in Europe, BP, Dutch Shell, the auto companies, came together with the European Union in Brussels in a partnership. We put in 2 billion euros R&D to get it going. And with the help of commerce and government, now we've got to bring in the civil society organizations, we've got a partnership. It's a tenuous partnership, but it's a partnership. When the United States companies found out about this, they went to the White House and said, we can't let Europe get ahead of this. So President Bush announced hydrogen in his State of the Union address 2 years ago, but his plan is somewhat different than our plan here in Europe. Remember I said there's 2 ways to extract hydrogen? The EU has no choice but to use renewable energy. And Mr. Prodi made this clear in his opening address at the EU summit on hydrogen a year ago. 22% of the electricity in Europe and 12% of the energy has to be renewable by 2010 to meet your Kyoto deadline. Then you got to double it to meet your Kyoto deadline for global warming by 2020. You can't do it unless you have a way to store that energy at that when you get to those points. You have to have hydrogen. But when the administration in the White House got a hold of this, they said, we want to go to hydrogen. We want to free you from oil. But what they didn't say is their budget was designed to put huge amounts of money to subsidize getting hydrogen from coal, clean coal, and developing a new generation of nuclear reactors. You know how much they're spending on renewable energy? $400 million a year. That's less than the cost of developing one football stadium. It's not serious. So there's black hydrogen and green hydrogen. There's hydrogen from fossil fuels and nuclear, and then there's renewables, black and green. Mr. Prodi, I think, is mindful of history. The Brits became the great world power in the 19th century, you folks. Why? You were the first to harness your vast coal reserves with steam power. America became the great power in the 20th century. We were the first to harness our vast oil reserves, the Texas oil wells, and then we borrowed the internal combustion engine from Daimler and Benz, Germany. Now, the European Union. 455 million human beings, crossing 25 member states from the Irish Sea to the doorsteps of Russia. And yes, you're in the Union, whether you know it or not. They've come together to create an incredible experiment in history. But this experiment requires a new energy regime. Remember I said that energy regimes and cultural regimes come together? If you examine how an energy regime is set up and how the power is distributed, you'll begin to see how the whole rest of the society operates. Our energy regime in the modern era was elite. Coal, oil, and gas are only found in certain parts of the world. It requires huge capital to extract and process and distribute them, and huge military establishments and geopolitical institutions to maintain control over them. And so we ended up in the 21st century with a couple of dozen energy companies and 500 corporations running much of the commerce of the world. And so we have the opportunity for now decentralized, horizontal power to the people energy. But only that will only work if we have a new dream, a new vision, a new cultural construct that's compatible with our new desire for a new, more participatory energy regime. European Union is a strange experiment, and you folks are too close to it. In fact, I guess the channel here between you and Europe makes you a little further detached, unfortunately, but I think you're all too close to it. Imagine this experiment. Every kingdom, every empire, every nation in history has been born out of violence until the end of World War II. Seizure of territory, sequestration of people and resources, and violence centralized in the state, even every nation state. The EU is the first experiment in history politically based on putting down the sword. After 1,000 years of conflict, this is the bloodiest continent in all of history. 2 world wars and a Holocaust, Europeans said, we're done. We're sick to our stomach. We can't kill each other anymore. We're going to try something counterintuitive. They didn't have that term then. We're going to cooperate, come together, create solidarity, pool our risks, share our trust. 50 years later, all the hatred and hostility between all these cultures fading. And today, 1/3 of all the young people in Europe say they think of themselves as Europeans first. It doesn't mean they've given up their national loyalty. You don't give up being British by being European. You gain a broader playing field. But what does this have to do with an energy regime? The new energy regime has to have a new dream accompanying it, or else there won't be the spirit, the social glue, that will be necessary to make it into the next place in history. You can't just say we have all this technology and therefore we're going to have the spirit to move it. We've got the technology. Where's the spirit? And here's what I would say to you. I believe there's a new European dream emerging. And I believe that the elements of this dream are the absolute essential components of a new distributive energy power for the world. To the extent that this dream is thick and is a social glue that works and is effective, we will move into a new energy era. To the extent this dream fails, we will not move into a new energy era. What is the dream? Let me contrast it to the American dream. And then all of the artists in here, I want you to kind of work and think about how we would begin to express this dream in all of our mediums so that we can begin to create a new covenant. Because new covenants are based on deep play. Deep play happens in the culture. The economy is just an extension of culture. It's just where we work to reproduce ourselves. But all the ideas that we use, they come from deep play in the culture, and it's up to the artists of this generation to help begin to bring this dream into everyone's life. So let's contrast the American-European dream. Which one's more compatible with a decentralized energy regime? I grew up in the heartland of America. My parents are from the West, Texas and Colorado. My siblings and I were born in Colorado, raised in the heartland in Chicago, weaned on the American dream, stripped to its essentials, the dream says, regardless of the circumstances upon which you're born, if you work hard, get a good education, you're determined, you can become a success, an individual success in the United States. It's a tough country, but it's a land of opportunity. That's our dream. Simple and direct. Until the 1960s, the dream was deep and real. We were the most middle-class, egalitarian society in the world in 1960. 44 years later, the dream is completely unraveled, unfortunately. Today, the United States ranks 24th among industrial nations in income inequality. Only Mexico and Russia score lower in the gap between the rich and poor that's happened in 40 years. That's an incredible devolution. Meanwhile, there's an emerging European dream. Europeans aren't even aware of it because Europeans are so used to living in America's shadow, they don't think they're worthy of a dream, but you've been developing the components. Well, look, I'm going to be frank. Every European I know, including the Brits, you spend countless parts of the day thinking about America, talking about America, wondering what's going on in America. Can I let you in on something? We never think about you. That's not entirely true. When we want to go on a holiday, we say, got to get to London, got to get to Paris. It's a destination center for our recreation. Actually, when most Americans think of Europe, and I'll put Britain somewhere a little bit on the side here, but when we think of Europe, we think of creaky old institutions, anti-market bias, inflexible labor pools, bloated government bureaucracy, a lot of red tape, collapsing welfare systems, and a pampered, aging old population ready to go to the old age home. Maybe a germ of truth. But what Americans are not realizing, and even many Europeans, there's a second epidermis here under the skin. And it says to me that Europe's on the verge of a new great cultural experiment, comparable at least to the Renaissance, probably to the age of Christianity in the whole era in the last 2,000 years. What do I mean by this? Contrast the American dream with what I think your dream is. When we Americans talk about freedom, we have something totally different in mind than when most continental Europeans think about freedom, and I don't know where Britain falls in. You can tell me in the Q&A. We think differently than Europeans. It's not a matter of style or clothes or language. We actually think different. It's like two relatives who were separated 200 years ago, and we sort of don't really know each other. When Americans talk about freedom, which is the heart of our dream, it's quite different than when a European, continental European, thinks about freedom. Our parents teach us freedom, the core of our dream, is autonomy and mobility. Learn to be self-reliant. Learn to be your own boss. Remember, it's a tough world out there, and no one's going to take care of you. You're going to grow up and learn you've got to take care of yourself because everybody's responsible for themselves. You are alone in this world, and you have to understand, swim or sink, and never, ever blame someone else for your life because it's in your hands. Do your parents teach you that here? Not so much, a few. But in continental Europe, you only had a few saying yes. But in continental Europe, that's not happening at all. I would say you're more into the continental tradition, but we'll get into this. Europeans teach their kids freedom is embeddedness, participation, connections, access, relationships. One is free to the extent one has enough embodied relationships to be able to make choices in one's life. We in America covet privacy. Europeans covet more relationships and connections. Now, how does this bear out in terms of the dreams? And keep thinking energy regimes. Elite energy regimes, distributive energy regimes. When an American thinks of the American dream, we think about primarily, but not exclusively, the accumulation of wealth. By the way, let me explain why the American dream converges from the European dream. Our founders came over here from Britain and from Europe 200 years ago at the waning days of the Reformation, the early days of the Enlightenment. We took those two currents of thought and we froze them in time for 200 years. The American dream is a European construct, pure, unadulterated, and never changed. That's how you can understand the American dream. The Reformation and the Enlightenment differ from each other fundamentally. The Reformation says, The Reformation says, suffer in this world, eternal salvation in the next. The Enlightenment says, pursue happiness, material cornucopia is waiting in this world. But what unites those two currents of European thought is the individual is at the core of both. Martin Luther and John Calvin said, you stand alone with your God. Adam Smith said, you stand alone pursuing your self-interest in the marketplace. John Locke said, you stand alone against nature. It fit the American frontier. We were alone. We were alone. We didn't have a lot of social support. So the idea of freedom as autonomy, independence, President Reagan with a cowboy hat on the horse, that's why so many Americans loved him. He was the last icon of that dream. But in Europe, by the 1800s, you were already densely connected. You didn't have much frontier or vacuum. So the idea of the individual didn't really create full sway in Europe. Now, I'll talk about Britain in a minute. Because you had an older tradition, the commune, fortress cities, the paternalism of the Catholic Church, feudal hierarchy, class position. Now, it is true that the idea of the modern individual came out of the Britain and Scotland and Ireland and Wales. It is true that the idea of the market economy, the nation state, it all emerged here on this little island. But there's an older tradition here too, and that's the paternalism, the communalism, the feudalism that created all sorts of obligations and relationships between people, even if they were stratified. So, what does this have to do with the way we think about the world and the next energy era and the way you think of it? We pursue wealth individually, not because we're in love with money like Europeans think. Because in America, we're taught you better learn to be self-sufficient. We don't have social supports. We don't have universal health care and all the retirement benefits and all the other benefits you have. So we have to be able to have enough money to survive. In Europe, the focus is not so much on individual pursuit of wealth, but quality of life. That's something the whole community does together. Why? Because in America, an individual could get rich, from Ford and Rockefeller and Carnegie to Bill Gates. But in a class society in Europe, there were more conditions. It's not so easy to become rich. So what's the substitute for that? Quality of life. The whole community does that together. Think about energy. The whole community does that together. Americans spend 12% of our GDP on social benefits. You spend 26%. So what you say, more in Europe, less so in Britain, but here too, we need a quality of life. The whole community takes their tax monies and we redistribute benefits so that we can all have a better way of life. It's not so much an individual pursuit, but a collective pursuit. Some of that changed in the last few years as the Labour Party shifted its position here in the UK. But remember, even as the UK is really the originator of the individual self in the market in Scottish economics, you also have a deep labor reform tradition that speaks to the older social communal values of this island and these isles. So the Americans, we like growth. Europeans increasingly say sustainable development. Why? Because in America, we had so much frontier. If you despoil an environment, you just leave the garbage and go to the next one. How many of you have been through America? You notice that it's strange how much blight there is, and then you'll see beautiful new communities, then you'll see blight, almost like they've been left behind. You don't see quite as much of that, I'm being charitable, throughout Europe. Because by the 1800s, you were so densely connected, you didn't have a lot of place to throw out your garbage and move. So you couldn't foul your nest. So if you look at urban-rural areas coming over the plains to London or any airport, you see how beautifully configured the layouts are. So even though Americans started the modern ecology movement in the 60s, we did a quick sprint and then we lost it because we have a deeper frontier tradition, move on. You had the long-distance run here because you have a deeper tradition, quality of life, don't foul your nest. It puts you more in line with Kyoto than we would have been. The American dream is heavily involved with property rights and civil rights. Property rights are an extension of our individuality. You have property, you're self-reliant. Civil rights are an extension of our individuality, the right to freedom of press, freedom of assembly, freedom of vote, freedom to bear guns. It allows us to be autonomous. In Europe, there's more emphasis on social rights, universal health care, full retirement benefits, maternity leave, paid vacations mandated by the state, and universal human rights. Jimmy Carter talks about them in America, but in the heartland, it's not a term that we actually use. You use it here, don't you? We really don't use it except on the coast and with NGOs. The American dream is assimilationist. We love immigration. We do better at it than anyone else, except the Canadians. But we say, come to America. We accept you. One condition, shed your former cultural ties. get into the melting pot, become a free agent in the market. In Europe, in theory, we'll get to the hypocrisy, respect multicultural diversity. Europe is valuable because it's a potpourri, one of the most diverse cultural regions in the world. Everyone has a gift to share. Strength is all of the diverse culture that we can have deep play and create our humanity. The American dream is heavily involved with the work ethic and the dictates of efficiency. We work longer than any people in the world, including the Koreans. The Europeans say, no, 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 balance work and leisure. We Europeans prefer to work to live. If you Americans want to live to work, so be it. You find out where Britain falls on this scale between America and Europe, and then you'll kind of know where you fall between the two dreams. So, the American dream is very patriotic. We're the most patriotic people in the world. In all the surveys of 50 countries, our kids will die for their country. Europeans are less patriotic. Not because they don't love their country, in continental Europe especially, but their identity is more layered. You go to continental Europe, you'll say, I'm a Catalonian, but I'm also a Spaniard. But I'm also a European. I'm also a member of the world. Same here in Britain. You might say, I'm from Scotland, but I'm also part of the United Kingdom. And increasingly, as you get the younger generations, I'm starting to feel European. You know what really united all the young people in Europe? The untold story of Iraq. When the Coalition of Willing was announced, even though a few governments like the UK and Poland went with the Coalition of the Willing, what happened in the streets? The biggest unified protest movements in the history of all of Europe for 2,000 years, and overwhelming majorities of the population in every single country in Europe came out and said, we don't want this war. And for the first time, people were on the streets thinking of themselves as Europeans. So as I'm always interested when they say European foreign policy is so divided, not among the people. So the American dream also is heavily involved in military. The reason is we are very religious people. A majority of Americans have a personal relationship to God. You may snicker, but it's heartfelt. Majority of Americans have had a born-again experience and believe God affects their personal day-to-day lives. Solid majority. So because of that, and Europe's secular to the core. But because of that, we think there's good and evil in the world. And not in metaphoric terms, in biblical terms. That's not all of Americans, but about a half, a little over half. So we think evil, you can't compromise with evil. You have to have a strong hand that's just. In Europe, war is an anathema. So many years of conflict, you say wage peace, don't make war. You say absorb conflict, create humanitarian assistance, reconstruction aid, development, war is last resort. So here's the two dreams between two energy eras. The American dream, very individualistic. Each person has the opportunity to succeed. Everyone's an island to themselves. The European dream, more collective. See if this makes sense and then see where you Brits fall on this line. Are you more to the European or more to the American experience? One, inclusivity. No one should fall too far behind between the rich and poor. There can be a gap, but not too big a gap. Two, honor multicultural diversity. Every culture has something to share. Three, honor a good quality of life, which is a community affair. We have to do that together. It's a collective exercise. Four, balance work and play. Five, promote sustainable development in our communities with our fellow creatures in the earth we live in. Six, honor social rights and, more importantly, universal human rights. And seventh, make peace. Are those the elements of a European dream? If they are, you can now own up to it and say, we have a European dream. Now, if you ask any American what the American dream is, none of those would be on the agenda in the heartland. We would say individuals have an opportunity to make of their life what they like. But if I ask young Europeans, all of those particulars would be part of the vision you have, right? I'm not saying you're living up to that dream. Of course not. Dreams are what you'd like to be. The hypocrisy, the shortfalls, it's just running rampant. You're nowhere near living up to the dream. We didn't live up to our dream. So, you know, multicultural diversity, yeah, but anti-Semitism, fear of Muslim minorities, fear of immigration. You talk inclusivity, but you have the Western countries fighting the new accession countries around economic power. You're worried about Brussels taking over your sovereignty. It's a mess. But what's interesting to me as an observer after 20 years here is not that you're living up to the dream, but your dream is so different than ours. Your dream is not on the radar screen except for a small minority. That doesn't mean Americans wouldn't be attracted to this dream. Many would. We just don't know it exists except for a small elite on the East and West Coast. So does any of these components of this dream have anything to do with a new energy era? inclusivity, multicultural diversity, sustainable development, a good quality of life for the community, honoring universal human rights and social rights, creating peace and harmony in the world? They're the absolutely essential linchpins for a social glue that would allow a generation of Europeans and people around the world to move to a participatory, deep participatory energy regime. What's so extraordinary about what you've done here in Europe is you've not only created the first transnational space, the EU. It's not a territory. That passport is a set of ideas. And now governed, if the Constitution's passed, by universal human rights. Extraordinary. But you're the first region in the world to have a global vision. European dreams, global consciousness, in a world that's deeply connected and vulnerable. It may be too ambitious. It may not succeed. You may become the Napster of new political spaces. You know, Napster failed, but all the other music companies took the model. The extent you succeed will depend on real-world results, and I think this is where we cut in to the new energy regime. I can think of no more fitting testimonial to the social glue, do you really believe in this dream, as to whether we are able to create a new energy regime across Europe that's a model for the world, that's participatory, inclusive, that honors everybody's rights to be, that's sustainable, creates good quality of life, and creates a world based on peace. We all participate in our energy. Many Euroskeptics are coming out of the woodwork. I'm going to end with this. I wrote this book for two reasons, The European Dream. I wrote it for Americans because we're in trouble. If you visited our country, a lot of angst, a lot of anger, a lot of polarization. A little over half the countries with the old American dream, a little under half the country would like a new dream, but they don't know there's anything beside the American dream, so we'd rather have a lousy dream than no dream. So I wrote the book saying, hey, look what these people are doing in Europe, our relatives. They're creating this new dream. It's taken 50 years. It's quite interesting. It's not what we're talking about. Maybe we can learn from these folks. That's an eye-opener for America, because our dream's been the litmus test and the beacon for the world. But I wrote the dream for Europeans, and I include you in Britain, because you're at a critical point, 50 years into this great experiment, the first global space and global vision, and you're getting cold feet. I see it in the British press. I see it in the European press. We have Euroskeptics, the intellectuals, the economists, the business people, and political leaders saying, the dream's over. Wake up. Sober up. We can't afford it. We had great dream, and we had great social programs. But our economy's stagnating. We're not growing jobs. We're going to have to give it up and go with the American model. Does this sound familiar? Let the marketplace rule. What would you give up and what if you get? And what do you get? Here's what you give up. If you measure the good economy in terms of the paycheck, we're 28% richer than you are, even though it's more unevenly divided between rich and poor. But if you measure the good life in terms of quality of life, you passed us up in the 90s in the EU 15. We have the best universities. I can say London School of Economics is a great school, Oxford and Cambridge. But across Europe, you don't have as many stellar universities as we have in the States. But at the elementary and secondary level, EU 15 passed us up in the 90s. Higher math and science literacy among your kids. Healthcare. We have the best healthcare, state-of-the-art facilities. If you're rich and can afford it, you're going to come to the Mayo Clinic. Garden variety healthcare, you passed us up. We don't even have universal healthcare. Only the US and South Africa has people without healthcare. You have more physicians per population than we do. You live a year longer than we do, even though you all smoke. I don't know how you do it. And infant mortality, if America is a great success, why do we rank 27th in infant death among industrial countries? Only a few industrial countries are lower, Mexico. Isn't that a mark of a society's greatness if their children are allowed to have a life? Can't have upward mobility if you die at birth. Look at leisure. You get 4 weeks off paid vacation a year. We get two and not mandated by government. And the average European gets 10 and a half more weeks off a year than we do. Well, some people say, well, that's ridiculous. We've got to work hard. The reason we're losing is we're not working hard enough. Well, my wife does the deathbed test, because I, too, am a workaholic. She says, do you know anyone on their deathbed that says, oh, I wish I could have spent another hour at the office. Maybe I could grab 20 minutes before I conk out. The environment, which is key to energy. We were way ahead of you in regulations up until 1970s. You passed us up. You're about to legislate a chemical REACH program that puts the onus on corporations to prove the chemicals are safe before they put them in the environment. We couldn't even introduce that in the US Congress. It's watered down, it's weak, but at least you've got it. You're the first to benchmark a transition to renewable energies and a hydrogen economy. You're the first to benchmark a transition to organic agriculture in various countries. You're the first to protect the rights of our fellow creatures, and we all owe that to the Brits. The mark of a civilization is how it treats those who are powerless. You taught us that when you created the first humane societies, which were designed to protect children and our fellow creatures. And if the Brits teach us nothing else, you know what I think the great legacy of this country is? You might find it strange. I think the great legacy is you educated the world that our fellow creatures have a right to be on this planet. Even if we're not here, they're not just here for us. And that we need to give them a voice. And so the European countries, with Britain as a lead, has extended the idea of protection. Our fellow creatures have a telos, and you just have a right to be here, whether we're here or not. We owe that to the Brits. Incredible what you've done here. So, what about safe communities? You figure a prosperous economy, a safe society, America's counterintuitive. We're one of the most dangerous places to live. No woman can go out after dark. Here it's dangerous, but not like America. We have 4 times your homicide rate. 25% of all the prisoners in the world are incarcerated in my country. 2% of the adult male workforce in my country is in jail. Now, why am I saying all this? There is a feeling in Europe, go to the American model. If you do, you have to give up all these social reforms because they're too costly, right? Everyone's going to be on their own. What do you get? What if the American model is a failed economic model? I teach business leaders on both sides of the Atlantic in the oldest business school in the world. That's what I do. I've been doing it for a long time. Can I give you my read on the real reality? There's not much difference between American CEOs and European CEOs in terms of innovativeness and technology advance. There's also the idea that the social reforms are what makes America a go-go economy, that we did all these draconian reforms, completely unrelated to what's going on in America. Apples and orange. Let me tell you what happened. In the early 90s, we came out of the 89 to 92 recession by putting out credit cards. We issued, this is going to start to sound familiar to you Brits. We started putting out credit cards to everybody. We started going on a buying binge. We started moving the economy on credit. The biggest credit binge in world history. We had an 8% savings rate per family in 1990. It was near zero by the year 2004. We mortgaged the future and built an economy based on debt. It's all artificially pumped up. And then one other country followed our lead into the abyss, the UK. And now we have UK citizens spending 120% of their income. That doesn't really compute. And now we say, you're the other success story. More people will file bankruptcy in America this year than will file for divorce, get cancer, have a heart attack, or graduate college. And if I'm wrong or right, all you have to do is, after this lecture, call up and exchange, check the exchange rates between the dollar and the euro. The investment community understands. We said the euro would be toilet paper in 6 months. Why is and mainly the Brits, too. Why is it strong against the dollar? My friends in the investment community don't trust the American economic fundamentals. There's too much debt. Consumer debt and now government debt to keep the consumers floating. And so the investment community says, we don't trust the fundamentals. This is an artificially pumped up debt-ridden society. We're going to continue to devalue the dollar because we don't believe you're going to pay off. So did we grow jobs? We've had a net loss of 1.6 million jobs in the last 4 years. That's a government figure. That's the only time that's happened. We've had a net loss of jobs. Was 1929, the beginning of the Depression. So if you go the American model and strip out all those reforms and give up all the achievements of the European dream, you'll get increased debt, which Britain has done. You fall right into the American trap, just like in Iraq. You'll get increased debt. Your children will have to pay for it. And you'll end up with more childhood poverty, a greater divide between the rich and poor. And you're the second country that's moving to the divide after us. And the dream is exploded. Now, what does this have to do with energy? There is a golden goose here. I know you can. You might say to me, Mr. Rifkin, maybe you're right. Maybe this we have this great global dream, and we have all these great benefits, but we can't afford it. Our economy is still not doing well, and even if we believe you, the American model has failed, we got to do something, right? Is there an alternative to the American model, if that's a failed model? There is. And this is my message for everyone in the United Kingdom who followed our lead into the debt trap. You have a big, fat, golden, you have a big golden goose. It ain't fat. It's being starved. It's not being fed. And it's so obvious if you detach yourself anthropologically just for a moment. What is the golden goose that can allow you to grow your economy, maintain the European dream, a global vision, and not reform, but still continue to have a social net with good programs for quality of life? Wouldn't it be worth having it all? Here's the golden goose that you're shooing away. It's called the integration of the infrastructure of the biggest potential internal commercial market in the world today, from the Irish Sea to the doorsteps of Russia. It is the European Union. So in the year 2000, European leaders met in Lisbon and said, we're going to be the most competitive economy by 2010. Then all the politicians went back to their home countries, center right, center left, and played local politics, and you still are with the new constitution. And what did they say? Oh, the EU is taking too much from us. Does this sound familiar? And so the trade unions, the EU is taking too much from us, and the corporations, the EU regulations are taking too much from us, and the NGOs, this looks like a World Trade Organization in a micro version, and it goes on and on. Does anyone here in this island believe that your future prosperity rests in moving back into a national container or moving out and integrating the largest commercial market on earth? Here's what needs to be done. There needs to be a single transportation grid across Europe in 10 years. There needs to be a unified energy and power grid across Europe in 10 years. There needs to be a coordinated communication grid among countries in 10 years. There has to be common regulatory policies agreed on and fairly done between all countries in 10 years, including policies on financial flows and labor mobility. If Europe can integrate its infrastructure, this golden goose, so that you can have commerce and trade with the same ease that we have in America over our 50 states, you will have a growth economy. That doesn't mean that you don't hit other obstacles. You're going to hit another wall. It's called demographics, low fertility rates, immigration, subject for another day. But to move the economy now, move it out of debt, and move it into integrating the infrastructure of Europe. And where does the new energy regime come in? Right at the center. In 2 weeks from now, I'm going to be in Rotterdam. The European Union's invited me there. They're bringing in 80 cabinet ministers from across Europe. Energy, communication, transportation, all the fields involved in the new energy regime. And I'm going to lay out something similar to what we talked about tonight. And then for 2 days, the cabinet ministers across every country in Europe are going to sit down and wrestle with, it's time to do this. Imagine the legacy if we can begin to create a new energy regime that's distributive and just and equitable and brings power to the people. Imagine if we can maintain this vision of a global consciousness to go with the new energy regime. Inclusivity, diversity, quality of life, sustainable development, universal human rights and peace. They go together, power to the people and global consciousness. And what would be the legacy? My charge here for you in Britain is you need to lead this game. You've been the brakes on this game. You need to lead this game. No country will go it alone in 30 years from now. No country's an island. And my most passionate hope is that a younger generation here in the United Kingdom will become leaders in the new Europe, both in advancing the social vision and advancing a new infrastructure based on a new democratic energy regime. Because the UK has the possibility of bridging both North America and Europe. You're between two. You're responsible in some ways for both dreams. You have been the architects of the American dream in part and the continental dream in Europe. Who else should lead? So if you can do that, and this great discussion starts here, you will send a message to America and the world that there is a new experiment, a new laboratory, and that we can have a social consciousness that's a global vision and a democratic energy regime that works, that sustains the planet. And here's the legacy: radically reduce global warming. You can't do that without a tough dream and sacrifice. Radically reduce the divide between the haves and have-nots so that our fellow human beings can be part of a new energy era and have a shot at a happy, prosperous life. Radically reduce the geopolitical tensions in the Middle East so that our boys and girls and the young boys and girls in the Middle East are not in harm's way. Defuse the agony and the distrust. Build the reciprocity among people. And if here in Britain you can lead that discussion in Europe and the world, bring us into a European dream that's truly a global vision, and help us move to a new energy regime that's truly sustainable for ourselves and our fellow creatures and just. Best legacy the young people in this room can leave for their children. Good night.
Thank you. a truly stunning and wide-ranging lecture, I think everyone will agree. I'm going to take just 15 minutes of questions. So if anybody would like to ask a question, can you make your point briefly, please? Excuse me, I'm just going to get a roving mic.
You've been so patient. You know, my wife always says, the older I get, the longer I talk. You've been very patient. Appreciate it.
Hello, Mr. Rifkin. My name is Trond Auckland. I work for Morgan Stanley. I wonder how you think the financial markets can stimulate the transition to the hydrogen economy, please.
I have been meeting with some of the major financial institutions at the CEO level for about a year. And what I've asked them is this question. Tell me your path to resurrecting the global economy. We're in trouble. The whole world's in trouble. We're at the end of an energy regime at $50 a barrel. We're at the end of mass labor as intelligent technology replaces our jobs. That's why we have a jobs problem. It's nothing to do with social reforms. We're eliminating jobs all over the world because we're eliminating mass labor. We're raising our energy prices. We're in an entropy watershed. We got big troubles. So I say to the banking and financial community, what is your roadmap to getting out of this mess? And I get silence. The great changes, economic changes in history, occur when we have a new energy regime combined with a new communication regime and lay down a new infrastructure for the world. Imagine the multiplier effect of agriculture and cuneiform. 10,000 years, that's a pretty long effect. Imagine the multiplier effect of the print revolution with the internal with the steam power and coal and rail. Imagine the multiplier effect with telegraph and telephone with the internal combustion engine, oil, roads, and cars. So what I'm saying to the investment community is, don't expect a killer app here. There's no killer app. There's no quick short-term deal you're going to make here. But you have to be cartographers. And that is, this is a huge sweep. There are all sorts of industries, all sorts of interests, and there's all sorts of problems. We have material problems with the new technology. We have regulatory problems. We have safety problems. We have price problems. I understand all that. I don't want you to get the impression we're just going to walk into the fuel cell era, but we had the same big problems with steam power and coal and with auto and the internal combustion engine. We got over that divide because there was a spirit that we could bring together the commercial life, the political life, and the civil life of the society to do it. So what I would say to the investment community, time to act like a cartographer. Find out all the places you can invest. Spread the money all over the world, the capital, and begin to lay out a long-term sustainable plan for developing a transition into a renewable hydrogen green economy. That's the only thing I can see that's going to move the economy, because if we stay with the existing financial path in an oil era, you think oil is going to go down to 20? It's going to go to 60 and 70 and 80 and 90, and we're going to get warmer and warmer, and we're going to get bigger divides. Does anyone here not believe that in this whole room? No. So the business community has to wake up, see the opportunities, and begin to work in partnership with government and civil society. It's going to take all three in a deep, mutual, respectful partnership.
Good evening. My name is Nico McDonald. I'm a writer. I very much enjoyed your talk. I'm particularly about the combination of energy and communication models. The changes that you're describing, you alluded to other changes in the 19th century, the move to oil and the internal combustion engine. The changes that you want to see take place have taken place before without the sense of crisis that you introduced this talk with, relatively successfully, and you talked about the spirit which motivated them. I'd like you to, if you wouldn't mind, go into a bit more the kind of changes that need to take place if we remove the apocalyptic view. And those might be in multiple innovations, which you've talked about, in social trends and understanding social trends, in developing infrastructure, and that's a very important part of our current economy, perhaps in design, in the way that we design things to make them more usable and desirable for people. Could you give us a little more detail about that? And just a follow-up to that.
I can say this. There are negatives and positives, and you're right. The negatives that are running this are global warming and third world debt and the Middle East and a lot of other negatives. The positives are we have an opportunity here for a great revolution, economic, scientific, technological revolution, but it'll only happen if we have a cultural revolution so that we have a set of principles and a vision of the future that's compatible with the new technology we want to put into practice. So if you're asking the positive side of this, what I would say here to writers and artists and those who express the vision of the future, help us understand the relevance of the components of the European dream: inclusivity, diversity, sustainable development, good quality of life, balancing work and play, universal human rights, and peace. Provide us the mediums in your artistic expression so that we can have a soulful discussion here in the UK and around the world, so that we can begin to bring this social glue together. If you would ask this question in America, what is the glue that's kept us together? It's not the Constitution, it's not Congress. When America, any Americans here? Test me if I'm wrong, especially the older generation. You're younger, I'm not putting you in my generation, but don't worry. But when Americans look at each other, and when we look at native-born and immigrants, we have this common understanding. It goes beyond all of our political affiliations, our religion, our class background. We say, hey, we're all here under common idea. We know it's a tough country, but we know it's a land of opportunity, at least until recently. And we know each person, you're on your own, but if you make it, God bless you. I don't envy you. I congratulate you. That's the understanding. Up until recently, that understanding worked. Now it's in trouble. What Europe has to have is that understanding. When you look at each other, from Britain to Poland, and when you look at all your young friends coming in as immigrants, that understanding is there between all of you. We may have a lot of differences. There may be a lot of variation here, but we agree to the vision of the future we want for our children, our fellow creatures in the earth: inclusivity, diversity, sustainable development, good quality of life, universal human rights, and peace. That's the beginning. And what I'd like to see is the artists of Europe and around the world, and I know you already are, because many of these themes have come to us from art. I understand where a lot of this has come from. But I would like the artistic community to make a big divide from postmodern deconstruction to global consciousness. What do I mean by this? We had to spend 20 years, writers and artists, deconstructing the worst excesses of modernity. So the postmodern period was a twilight era where we had to say, hey, one container doesn't fit all. It's not just about nationalism or capitalism or the Enlightenment. There are many narratives. There are many stories. We have to start realizing that when you go to one story, it hurts everyone else. We did a great job of deconstruction, and art started this process, deconstruction. But there is a critical point where the deconstruction has now done its job. If it goes any deeper, it leads to nihilism. And what the European dream has done is it provided an opportunity to move from postmodernity, which is the twilight era where we deconstruct modernity, to a new era where we have a global consciousness. It's based on diversity, but it's based on common agreements: universal human rights, sustainable development, inclusivity, peace. So for all the artists who have been engaged for 20 years here in a postmodern critique, now it's time to re-engage and help us understand what a global consciousness would be all about, to move us to a new era of aesthetics for art and for writing.
Well, very briefly, I mean, the point I wanted to make just follows up on that. I find a lot of people seem to be very happy-clappy almost about the crisis we seem to be in, which is an odd way to behave. And the results you alluded to today about the impact of CO2 in the environment from a study in the Antarctic, I believe, people seem to sort of relish it almost. And I think the culture that I see around us is a bit more jaded than the one you describe or you aspire to, where we talk about risk a lot. We have quite an apocalyptic perspective on things. We're very precautionary in the way that we approach things. We tend to blame others. And if you've spent any time in London, you'll know that we all think people who drive SUVs are the devil, which is a very odd way to behave in this new culture. Now, clearly it's not the culture you're describing, but I wonder to what extent those kind of characteristics in our culture may actually inhibit the kind of innovation that we need to make to move forward.
When I was wrestling with the last part of this book, I was stuck in the part where I was talking about, you know, you got to open up the gates to immigration. I know everyone's afraid of it. You know, the immigrants, and let's name it, we're really talking about a lot of people are afraid of Muslim minorities, not so much European Muslim minorities, but Arab Muslim minorities. That's the fear. Going to overwhelm the culture, going to take the remaining unskilled jobs, going to have more crime in the streets, more social instability, more isolation between the natives and the immigrants, and it's going to create xenophobic right-wing fascist political movements across Europe like we had in the 30s, right? On the other hand, does anyone think you can close up Europe? People are going to come anyway. You're on the tip of North Africa. They're going to come anyway. And can we have a global dream and then lock up Europe and say it's a global vision, but only for those of us that are here in the 25 states from the Irish Sea to the doorsteps of Russia? So when I was getting to this point in the book, I was thinking, What is the way this all holds together? And this may be instructive for the artists here. So I went back, because I didn't know either, and I went back to the last two periods of history to try and use them as analogies in my mind. If you go to medieval Christian Europe, think of the art, go to medieval Christian Europe. What was the universal human condition? We're all sinners. Think of the art, the theater. We're all sinners. What was the dream? Salvation in Christ in the next world. What was the social glue? Faith. How was it embedded structurally? The feudal hierarchy, the great ladder, the social responsibilities. And how was it expressed in art? All those ways, no? Now move up to the post-Enlightenment era. First and second industrial revolutions, the energy era we're talking about. We changed the idea of the human condition in the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment philosophers, Condorcet and Descartes and Locke and Newton and Smith, they had a different idea. The universal condition is not fallen nature, we're all sinners. It's we're all materialists, we're acquisitive, right? We are material beings. From Adam Smith to Karl Marx, they agreed, we are first and foremost a material being. Or to quote one of our great sages in the arts of the last 20 years, it's a material world, I'm a material girl. Now, she's onto the Kabbalah, so we should watch where she's going. She may have something to tell us. But the interesting thing about it is, if we are a material being, what's the dream in the modern era? Cornucopia, material progress. What's the glue? Property rights. I'm sorry, rational behavior, not faith. What's the embeddedness? Property rights in the nation-state container. Now, artists here, what's the new universal condition that you see in your art in the era of globalization? What do all people feel together now? If they don't feel they're all materialists and they don't feel they're all fallen sinners, what do you think the one word would be to describe how people feel about themselves in this new globally connected world? Anybody? Vulnerable? Vulnerability? We've globally connected the world. We're densely interconnected, whether we like it or not. And we all are affected by behavior somewhere else that we can't control. Isn't that how we kind of feel? Not just 9/11. And I'm sure it's expressed subterranean in your art. Vulnerability. So even Bill Gates, that's why the American dream doesn't work anymore. It's too based on individual containment. That's why nation states can't go it alone. It's based on containment, autonomy. Even Bill Gates can't be free as an island in a world where a computer virus or a SARS epidemic or a terrorist attack or global warming even penetrates his world of freedom as exclusivity. It doesn't work. So if vulnerability is the new condition we all feel, what's the dream? Global consciousness, that's the European dream. And you Brits help bring this dream to the world. What is the glue? If it isn't just faith or reason, empathy? That's the strangest feeling of all. And that's a feeling, if the artist can help us with this one. Empathy, you know, is it's biological in mammals, but it's also socially conditioned. When I empathize with you, it's because I feel your suffering and I can reach out to myself, because if I've suffered, I feel you're struggling to be. You ever had a little wounded animal in front of you? And you just feel for that animal's attempt to live, to be, to experience their telos. They're only here one time. You can almost smell their intensity to be, because we've been there. Why is this important for art? As I've gotten older, and I don't mean to be too modern about this, as I've gotten older, I get depressed at night sometimes about the suffering. When you really think about the suffering in this world through all of history and our own lifetime, if I were God, I wouldn't have set this planet up this way. It is so full of suffering. Think about it. You'd go insane if you actually thought about it. But then I thought, maybe there's a silver lining here. I mean, people of faith, they believe, okay, I believe in the next world, in Christ in the next world, and I don't disparage that at all. But what is the silver lining for all the suffering? Maybe all that suffering, and including those two world wars and that Holocaust, maybe the silver lining is we have suffered so much. If we don't go into stress syndrome, traumatic stress syndrome, or recoil into ourselves, or lash out in anger, maybe the suffering allows us to empathize more. Huh? And what is empathy? I recognize your right to be. That's all it is. I feel your struggle and I recognize your right to be. How do we codify that? Remember I said property rights is the embeddedness of the modern era, proprietary obligations on the feudal economy. What's the way we embed empathy? I recognize your right to be. universal human rights. That's why this is, Jimmy Carter's right, it's an extraordinary change. I recognize women, I recognize children, I recognize minorities, I recognize our fellow creatures, I recognize the earth. What is so extraordinary about this Constitution that they're starting to trivialize with local politics? Look at this Constitution carefully. At the center is a not very elegant or eloquent fundamental charter of universal human rights. It's really the centerpiece. But what's so amazing about this universal human rights is it's extraterritorial for the first time. We began to develop universal human rights at the Nuremberg trials. And then the UN developed all these declarations for universal human rights. Why haven't they been accomplished? Because it's still nation states that can confer the rights or take them away. How can a right be universal if the UK can say, I grant you the right or I take it away? The Charter of Fundamental Rights means that your rights supersede the jurisdiction of the UK. That's hard for people, or Germany, or France. They're encoded by law, backed up by the European Court of Justice. And what is the European Union? It's a set of ideas. It's not geography when push comes to shove. And I know here in this country, there's somewhat of a debate saying, hey, we don't want our courts to be overridden by the European Court of Justice, but that's the whole point. The first attempt to create a global set of embedded structures that can honor universal human rights. So what I'm saying here is for the artist, help us understand how suffering leads to empathy. Help us understand how empathy leads to the idea that we are multiple creatures in a single family. Help us understand global consciousness. Help raise the bar so that when we walk into the theater or we take a look at that piece of art on the wall, what we see is hope. What we see is a new aesthetics based on promise, on a new metaphysics, on deep play, on making the bond with the planet. I think that's the way for artists to help us move this dialogue.
On that note, I'm going to draw the proceedings to a close. If you've got outstanding questions, then ask them of each other after the lecture closes. I'd like to thank you for your attention and for your contributions. I'd like to thank Adav Suhr for her introduction on behalf of LIFT, and above all, I'd like to thank our lecturer for an extremely stimulating couple of hours.
Thank you, Pete.
Many thanks.
Thank you very much.